This is the Wheeler Centre podcast.
My name's Madeline Morris. I host the Question Time series here at the Wheeler Centre. And tonight we're talking about a subject which is actually very much in the news today. For those of you who may have caught Q&A last night, our Education Minister Simon Birmingham saying that some private schools are getting too much money, too much government money. And of course, what we're talking about tonight is public versus private. And this is so important to anyone who's had a kid, anyone who's been to school, which hopefully is all of us, people like me who are just 7 months pregnant and trying to plan ahead of what I'm going to be doing for my kids' schooling. So it's such an important issue to all of us. And this issue of private versus public is one of the most vexed ones that we face. In Australia, 34% of all children go to private or Catholic schools, which of course receive government funding. Is it worth the money? Is it worth, as a parent, scrimping and saving and going without yourself in order to put your kids through? Well, statistically, yes, but are academic results what it's all about? And once we take out some social factors, is that actually eliminated? And these are some of the things we're going to be talking about tonight. Some of the other things that you might like to think about are whether the big question, should we all be having public schools only in Australia rather than private schools? And what level of funding should private schools get? So we've got a really great panel here tonight to discuss this with a wealth of information as parents and as educators as well. So I will introduce them all. So Ella de Brereton spent 43 years as a teacher, assistant principal and a principal in the government school system. Her last 16 years were as principal of Camberwell High, where she oversaw the school achieving great results, coming in the top 12, I think, state schools in Victoria. And she's now on the board of Methodist Ladies College, where you are also a former student. So she has experience of both, and she does some consulting as well. David Zinger is a senior lecturer in the Faculty of Education at Monash University. He's also a former school principal and a state school teacher. He has a wide field of research, particularly looking at social impact. And Lucy Clark is a journalist and editor at The Guardian Australia, and her new book about the school system is called Beautiful Failures. It was inspired by her daughter, who just did not fit into school at all, and she can explain why. And before I forget, Lucy's book, Beautiful Failures, is on sale at the back, and she'll be hanging around tonight if anyone would like a signed copy of that. So how Question Time works is it's a full Q&A, so the questions come from you. I'm just here to play traffic cop. And I would just raise your hand. I pretty much can't see anyone up here, but we have two ushers, and they will come to you if you have a question, and we'll try and make our way up and down the room. I will warn you, if you have a question, a burning question, do get in very early because the hour really does fly. So with that, I just wanted to just to kick off with the big question, I think, which we can then unpack further on. But I'll start with you, Elida. Are private schools better than state schools?
Well, again, it depends what you call judge better to be. And there's great variation within private schools, just as there is between government schools. So I think in the end, you've got to find that school where you believe the quality of the teaching, the quality of the care is there, rather than number of tennis courts and swimming pools and trips around the world. So it's a hard question, because I do have a foot in both camps, but my life's been teaching in government schools, and so I'm very, very committed to those. So is it better, government schools, private schools? I guess part of it is because of the image and perhaps sometimes snobbery, but sometimes just pressure to have your child at a private school. I remember parents at Camberwell High sometimes saying, oh, we're the only parents when we meet in Boroondara that have got kids in a government school, as if it was something disgraceful, and, you know, they'd slipped in somehow to the coffee shop. And yet, clearly, private schools if they don't have as good teaching going on, if they become used to what they're doing, then they are going to be less challenging than a government school in the sense of the good sense of challenging students.
Because, David, private schools do, you know, if you're looking at rankings, private schools are better, aren't they? They get better academic results.
Well, in fact, I actually did some research that was published earlier this year on that exact question about academic results. And yes, it's true that the top 10 performing schools, excluding Melbourne High and McRobb and other select entry schools, are those top 10 or 12 performers are private schools. Private schools are also select entry when you look at them, because they are charging fees of about up to $30,000 per student per annum, and that's after tax. It's very selective. Only certain people can afford to pay for that. But when I looked at the results and compared their VCE results to private schools, between private schools and public schools, and then looked at their what's called their social economic status index, ICSIA index, in fact, those top 12 schools outrank in social economic status performance the next tier of public schools. But when you compare like public schools with like private schools, in actual fact, the public schools outperform, just marginally, but outperform similar socioeconomic status private schools on VCE results. Mm. By the way, the average fee or cost per student in a private school is $23,000 per annum per student for the private school education. And the average cost of educating a high school student in Victoria last year was $10,400. So for that extra $13,000, there's no additional bang for your buck when it comes to academic results, for sure.
Okay, there might be bang for your buck in other areas, though.
Maybe.
Depending.
They can get a better swimming team together, perhaps.
Yeah, okay. We'll come back to the research, because there's a hell of a lot of research about this, and some of it conflicting, and obviously secondary and primary. But Lucy, just to bring you in, I mean, I think you should probably explain what your book is about, what inspired
sure.
it,
sure,
and what you found.
Yes. So my book came from a very personal place, which was my daughter's high school experience, which was it was a struggle for her to get through school. And she went through a state school, a government school, in the last few years of high school. The pressure and the competition made her shut down. And it was she was made anxious by school, and she was a square peg trying to fit into a round hole. So we really got her over the line to finish school, but she basically failed everything. The system judged her to be a failure.
Hence the name Beautiful Failures.
Beautiful Failures. Book. My Beautiful Failure, My Daughter. The article I wrote, the headline was My Daughter, My Beautiful Failure. And I got so much feedback from people who felt that they related to this experience that we went through and that she went through, that I knew that there were so many more issues to explore. And as a journalist, I kept asking questions and sort of went into a world where, you know, all children matter beyond just my own child mattering. And I've got experience in all sectors of education. I've got three kids, and I've, you know, they've been in public, private, selective and religious. And so I feel I've sort of subjected my little laboratory rats to enough experimenting. And I spent a year thinking and researching and also challenging a whole lot of personal biases and prejudices about school systems. And it was really, really interesting. And my book is the result of that. But to go back to your marvellous big question that set this off, and, you know, Elida saying, you know, what does better mean? This is the question, is, you know, what is academic success? What does success in school mean? And that was the driving, that was the engine that drove my book. Really. But in a bigger way, the question is also better for who and better for what? Is it better for society that we have quite a divided system? And you know, these are obviously really big questions that we hope to nut out.
And so, well, just give us the position that, that you came to at the end of your year, because researching and writing your book, because it wasn't the position that you started off with.
No, it wasn't. And, as I said, I did a lot of thinking, and I've got a child who's going into year 12 in an expensive private school. I've got a third child who I have decided will go to the local public school because of all the research and thinking I did on this issue. And it's very complicated and complex, but, you know, you have an ideological position, and then the practical is what trips us all up, because we can all have a position on, you know, we believe in state schools, we believe in public schools, and we want to support that system. But as long as there is choice in the system that we have, parents with the agency are going to try and get their kids ahead, because we've come to think of education as a race. And so those with the financial ability will try and get a better education for their kids. So this is why we keep coming back to this, the core of it is, what does better mean? Mm. And does, you know, being under appalling pressure in a high-achieving school and crying yourself to sleep at night mean success in education? So it's a really great discussion to have, and to, you know, open up this can of worms.
Okay. Do we have any questions to start off with? Yes, Sarah. There's a man there in the centre. Just if you can just wait until we get the microphone to you, and then ushers, if you can really clearly put up your hands, that'd be great.
Yes. In regards to the benefits of private schools, the level of churn between year 10 and year 11, is that higher in a private school than it is in the state schools?
What do you mean by churn?
Where they say you're not going to be, you don't fit into our system, and it's probably better that you go somewhere else.
Who can answer that question?
Well, public schools, by their very nature and their definition being public, are meant to be free, compulsory and secular. And any child who turns up at the door of a public school in year 10, if there's place, room for that child, and if there's not a restriction of you have to be living in a particular zone, as some of our schools now, because they've become overcrowded and overpopular, they do have zones. If there's room in that school, then the principal will welcome that child into that school. On the other hand, private schools, by their very nature, are selective, as I said initially, in that they can select who stays and who pays and who goes. And if they go, they will be going to another public school or another private school perhaps.
And how common is that for private schools to, once they get to that crunch period of year 11 and 12, actually say to students who may not be academically performing and going to drag down their overall school results, you better think about somewhere else?
Well, I don't think there's any published research on it, because the private schools actually don't release those figures. There's a lot of anecdotal evidence out, and of course the public schools themselves know, and Alita can testify to this, having taught in Camberwell for so many years in the heart of the private school, elite private school precinct, how many of her students would have come under suspicion from another select entry girls' school or boys' school around the corner. So perhaps a leader might want to give us some information on that.
Yeah, that's quite correct, that every government school has to take every student. I have heard of some government schools deciding to make year 10 so difficult at the end of the year and trying to pressurise some of the students to get to leave then to keep their results better. But very few. I've heard just the odd one where that's happened. But I think in private schools, I think there may be a tendency in some schools to set the bar very high, which is gentlemen's asking about, and removing them. And then certainly the other end, as David said, at Camberwell High, we had students coming from private schools, sometimes expelled and sometimes just really persuaded very heavily to get out.
Well, so was there a reason that you asked that question? Did you have personal experience with that in particular, or was it just out of interest? Because if you have a personal story about it, tell us.
I don't necessarily have a story about it, but it's just something that I know that happens within some of the higher higher ranking public schools mm-hmm. that they do churn students out at year 10 so that the principals can make their schools a better school and hence get that better academic average for year 11 and 12 or mm-hmm. particularly the ENTR scores.
Mm-hmm.
So my query was more based on private schools, whether there's any evidence to see that that churn actually occurs where they force the kids out of the private school because they're going to affect their ENTR score average.
Okay, did we have another question down the back? Yes.
Actually, my question was pretty much on par with the gentleman in front. Yes, I was going to ask as well, as the gentleman in the front asked, in public schools as well, I've noticed that in certain schools or certain districts, such as the eastern suburbs, if a particular student or bunch of students aren't performing very well, in year 10 they might be given sort of a tap on the shoulder and suggested that they go elsewhere so that it might increase the school's overall performance in the VCE ranking.
Mm-hmm. Now, Elida, how much pressure is there on school principals in the public system to get academic results high?
Well, it's a great dilemma. First, can I just reply to both the questions which are similar? Let us say that I am year 11, 12 coordinator, VCE coordinator, and I know that Freddie or Mary is coming up from year 10 as a troublemaker, lazy, painful parents, or maybe no parents, all of that, and I really would love to get rid of either of those. My teachers might drop hints and persuade and might fail them and anything you like. However, the parent only has to ring up the education department and carry on and scream and yell, and fair enough, they've got their rights, and then that child's back again. So even though sometimes we would have loved to have done that, we didn't do that because we just felt this was extremely short-sighted, and we tried to work with them. I think it's very sad in some ways that the technical schools were closed down, because I think they served a wonderful purpose, and I don't mean a second-rate purpose. They actually engaged students for whom academia was not really their portion, and they were terrific. And TAFEs and all the rest of it. But getting back to our question here, you can tap students on the shoulder and suggest that they might, like once students were made to repeat even, and nowadays, again, a parent will say, no, the social life of my child's far more important and the morale and so on, and so we wouldn't push that. But schools, I think, nowadays realise that you've really got to try and do something with that child, mm-hmm. turn them around.
Mm. But how much pressure is there on state school principals?
Yes, good.
To actually achieve academic results? And in my introduction to you, I said
yes.
How you had lifted Camberwell High into the top 12 state, because clearly it's a mark of status. It's a mark of achievement.
Yes.
So how much pressure did you feel, and do you think other state school principals feel on that academic front?
Yes. I think we feel enormous pressure. When we see the list come out at the end of the year ranking every school, we think to ourselves, are parents of good students, of, you know, academically strong students, they won't put their child into my school because we're down here. And why are we down here? Because it's a self-perpetuating cycle. Some parents will ring up and they'll say, tell us your average median score in VCE last year. Now, this is for year 7. So we might say, oh, 72, out of 100, the median. Or if it's the study score, we might say the study score median was 32, whatever, out of 50. And some parents will say, I'm sorry, I'm not interested in that school. So gradually you end up, as David said before, we had 39 private schools around Camberwell High, little oasis. You end up with, and some of the students were there philosophically, the parents could have afforded a private school but chose Camberwell High. But we also had students that would not have been allowed to even take up a private school in terms of their base, their academic results and so on. So there's enormous pressure on principals, and I can remember big discussions at Camberwell High where the staff were split down the middle. Maybe the middle's wrong, maybe it was two-thirds, one-third, but anyway, we were split with, are we a local government school? Are we a local public school? where we take everyone and we nurture them, or are we trying to really become an outstanding school academically and really trying to do little funny things like have an entrance exam, which of course is illegal and we never did it, but we suspected that some of our competitors in the government system had ways of weeding out which students came in and which ones didn't.
Mm. But this is the issue with rankings, isn't it? And we've got this dogged focus on competition and rankings, and it's not just on principals, it's on teachers in the classrooms, and the end user is the child in the classroom. Mm. And they're under enormous pressure as well, because we rank our kids, we rank our teachers, we rank our schools. Mm. This is the way we talk about education. We reach for the easy handles of grades and rankings and the figure at the end. And I think this is where we need to shift the conversation about education and talk about it in different ways. I don't blame parents wanting to talk about grades with their kids. Are you going to be an A student? Are you going to be a B student or a C student? It's the wrong conversation to have, because, if that's all we concentrate on, then this self-perpetuating notion, as Elida says, is this, it's a competition, it's a race, and you've got to get to the top. And that means that so much that is wonderful and meaningful about education is stripped out on the way.
So just to get back to our original premise of private versus public, could that not be where private schools have a role, because private schools typically have more money for extracurricular activities, for drama, for sports, for those sorts of things which the non-academically inclined child might excel in. And maybe your parents go, you know what, I'm happy to pay 25 grand as long as you're in the school play every year and that makes you really happy and that's going to further your ambition. I mean, could that be a role for...
Yes,
private.
But why shouldn't all children have access to those sorts of ideas about education? I mean, if we continue with this very narrow view of what academic success is, then we will end up with a very divided system. You know, all kids should feel like they have options in school.
Yeah. If we look at the top performing school systems around the world, all of them are public systems. They are public
Finland
systems.
Number one?
Finland's no longer number one because Finland has made its focus on what we call equity. Mm. And through distributing funds equitably amongst their schools, amongst their regions, by focusing on making sure that every local school is a good school, they were able to surprisingly, and they surprised themselves, they never had an ambition, a desire to become numero uno.
In fact, they said, what did we do wrong? We don't concentrate on the academic.
Exactly. So they became number one by default because they had less of a divide between the lowest and highest performers. Australia, on the other hand, has the highest gap between the highest performance and the lowest performance. We call that the long tail of underachievement. Mm. If every student or every school system in Australia performed as well as the ACT or Victorian even, we would, as Australia, be number one or number two in the world. But I'd like to reiterate that all the leading schools, whether they are Finland, whether they are Canada, whether they are in Taiwan, Singapore, Korea, South Korea, these are all the leading schools according to a test called PISA, if you take that with a grain of salt, but they are all by and large public school systems.
But then you talk about, I'm not the expert, but you just mentioned a few countries there where my understanding of the system is that it may be public, but it's extremely focused on academic results, such as Korea and Taiwan. So perhaps it's not surprising that even though it is public, that they are in those top rankings.
Look, in fact, the so-called Asian tigers, while they have public school systems, most of the students go to cram schools after public school and they spend hours there. And I actually teach at Monash University a whole bunch of these students who are now, as international students, coming to Australia to study here. And they tell us of their experiences, how hard they had to work to get an A level to get into university, that is excellent levels. And they went to school and they studied all day and then they studied all afternoon and they studied all night.
And
they,
is that what we want?
No. Well, of course it's not what we want for our Australian kids. And it comes back to the vexed question is what does it mean to be a good school and what does it mean for a student to achieve well at school? But I want to go back to the question from the rear and to indicate that while public schools, you may have heard of some public schools pushing some kids out, by and large, public schools have a much better track record of providing for children who are not able to perform at the academic level to get a decent enter. A, they don't want to go to university. And so a system called VCAL, Victorian Certificate of Applied Learning, was developed for that express purpose. And almost all the schools, not all the schools, but almost all the schools that provide a VCAL course for the non-academic students are located in public schools. And so that's where the underachieving private school students end up going to if they can't make it in their private schools. Private schools, by contract, tell the parents whether they can keep their kids there or not. And the parents cannot complain about it. They've got no one to complain to. As Alida said, in a public school, if parents want their child to remain at that school, the child will remain at that school, come hell or high water.
Got another question on that side, yes?
I have a raft of questions, but I think the first one, if I could just ask the panel's opinion on the role of the principal. And Enida, I'm specifically talking to you, I suppose, because Camberwell High School is definitely not 12 at the moment. So if the panel could tell me the role of the principal, because also I know of contemporaries of mine who selected their private school based on the principal who's in charge. When the new principal comes in or a principal is seen as underperforming, then they might reconsider that school. So if the panel could just tell me the role of the school principal in both the public and private schools, and also maybe if you could add, for public schools, what does the effect of having to answer to the DET have?
First of all, in Ellida's defence, Camberwell High School is in the top 12 state schools, public schools.
At the moment?
Yes. Absolutely. If you remove the select entry schools, Melbourne High, McRobb, and the new ones, John Monash, etc.
I can guarantee you it's not in the top 12. If you go by the Better Schools website, or whichever, what's your criteria?
Well, if you go by VCE results and enter scores.
No, then that's
it might be 13, might be 14 last year.
All right, I think this is not really the central thrust of the...
I'll start off, given I've got the microphone. Sure. I'm going to quote research because that's what I do. I'm a researcher. So John Hattie, if you're familiar with John Hattie, Professor John Hattie at the Melbourne Graduate School of Education, very famous for his work called Visible Learning. He is the guru in this area, and he has looked at what are the attributes, what are the factors that lead to academic success in a child, and he's looked at over 2,500 meta-studies around the whole world over many, many years. 50% of the determination of a child's academic performance is fixed in stone before the child sets foot in the door. That's the child's parents, what their parents' education level is, where their parents live, and what they do for a living. The other 50% are all school factors. And while we love to talk about wonderful principals, the principal, John Hattie says in his research, has about 10% of that effect. The most significant effect on a child's academic performance, time and time again, we find it in the research, not just from John Hattie's work, 25% of that is the school teacher, the teacher that the child has. If we had quality teachers, as we do in the public school system, that were well-resourced to meet all the needs of the students and the different needs of the students in their classrooms, then we would be a leading public school system.
Eleanor?
Yes, I'd like to comment on the section of your question about the pressure on principals from DET, the Department of Education and Training, and it's had many, many iterations. My PA used to call it the Education Department after it was about 15 different things, and I said to her one day, keep saying that, Glenys, it'll be back to the Education Department. It still isn't. It's mm-hmm. DET, it's been DCD, DSO, etc. The principal does have a key role, but I agree with David and Professor John Hattie. The principal has a key role in ensuring, first of all, that the staff are all professional and that they're growing, they're learning and that they are moving with the times. The principal also should set the tone of the school and should be setting high expectations for every child and also for every teacher. And also the principal should have, not a hands-on, you know, you're not there to interfere in classrooms, but should know what's going on in classrooms, should walk around the school, be visible, notice things. The question, the little bit about the accountability to the department is a very good question, because every year when I had, we had performance reviews of all the staff, and it was like a pyramid. You know, I did the performance review of my two assistant principals, and they did the performance reviews annually of the sub-school heads, and they did the year-level coordinators and so forth. And the head of curriculum looked at the heads of learning areas or faculties and so on. And the person that came in to do my review had to be an external person. I can't have one of my own staff saying, oh, you're good or you're a rat bag, whatever. That person that came in to do my performance every year and possibly recommend or even a raise, an incremental pay rise or something like that, came in with what was called the school level report. Now, I think it's a little bit, I've been retired now 6 years, but I'm still working in government schools with intern principals part-time. They came in with this massive document of accountability. It had in it the parents' opinion survey, totally anonymously done by a big sample of parents. The students' attitude to school survey. Every child on one day of the year fills in the DET survey for their own year level and so on. It has all sorts of questions like, I feel safe, I'm bullied, the teacher knows how I learn, I love coming to school, blah, blah, blah. It has sick leave of staff and of students. It has absence and everything. It has every result academically against benchmarks for every subject in the state, every VCE subject. There's a box there. It shows, say, Camberwell High here. The state average is above it or below it, and you hope it's below it. And there's whiskers, box and whiskers, so I know the best kid in my school was up here and the worst one was way down here, or maybe they're there and you hope they're, you know, the top one's way up and the bottom one isn't too low. You have the NAP plan results, you know, that test that they all do at years 3, 5, 7, 9. And so you have a massive amount of data by which I was judged as to whether I was a good principal. And it's a scary thing. And I can remember when the first year when it came out that way, that we'd have the person from the region coming in and giving us all this book, this great thing, and or that it was coming online that night before they came in with it. I remember one of the primary prins in Boroondara ringing us all up and emailing us and say, who wants to come and have a drink? Because this is going to be terrible. And it was scary.
So, but look, just to play devil's advocate, I mean, if you were running a major company with 1,200 employees, your shareholders and the bottom line of your company would be what you were judged on. Isn't that fair that you're judged on all
it
that?
It is, but what the point I'm about to make, which I didn't make, was that many private schools would not have anything like that pressure on them.
Right.
They wouldn't have, for example, that much
data. You're getting more government
because
money.
Because they're not part of a government. That's right. Oh, yes, there's reasons for it. I'm not denying that.
Yep.
And, in fact, it wasn't bad. When you got the staff opinion and you got to the staff morale, and if it had gone up a bit, you'd be wrapped. You'd just about rush off and become an alcoholic with joy because the staff were happier, you know, and so on.
Yeah.
So, yes, no, you're right. We have to be accountable, but it just shows that we really have to earn our keep in the government system.
Sure, and sure.
If I can just pick up on something you've just said, that government schools get more money.
Hmm.
And, in fact, that's no longer the case.
That's right.
As of next year, the majority of Catholic schools getting more government money than the neighbouring public school. We need to recall that that's one of the anomalies in the funding system that Birmingham's pointed out.
Sure. And that's why it was actually so interesting that he said what he said last night, yes. was because that's the tough political decision, really, when it when we talk about no school will lose a dollar. Do our politicians have the guts to say, OK, we're going to take it away from some schools that we previously said would never lose any money and redistribute it to the schools that really need it?
Mm. Yeah, look, in actual fact, if the Gonski Review school resource standard was applied equitably, there'd be public schools that would lose money as well.
Mm-hmm.
And because they're doing very, very well, the public schools in the eastern leafy suburbs are very well equipped and could be classed as over-resourced compared to the kind of school that I taught in, Jordanville Tech, for many, many years.
All right, let's have another question. And, Ushers, if we can have some questions down the back as well. I'm seeing quite a few questions, a few hands raised down there. Yes, please.
Given the current condition of our education in this country is common knowledge, what do the panellists think if private schools were shut down? What do they think would happen?
I think it would be great.
we would be saving. It's been estimated that by the Productivity Commission that the country would save $2 billion a year in the education budget if there were no private schools.
And imagine.
I'm not against private schools, by the way. I believe if parents should have a choice, but if they want to choose, make a lifestyle choice, they should pay the full cost of it.
Why should they have a choice?
Because we don't live in that kind of society. I in the best possible world, I would just love to have just public schools. But we don't have that situation. We have people who have religious beliefs who want to send their children to a religious school. Mm-hmm. And I believe that in a free society that we cherish in this country, mm-hmm. That they should be entitled to that right. But if they want to fulfil that right, and it's an entitlement, it's not, then they should pay for that entitlement. It's the same as I make a choice today. I came in here by public transport.
Mm.
I didn't come by car, and I don't expect people who have driven in on the tollway on the M1 to get a subsidy from me who's taking public transport. Mm. They pay for that entitlement, for that privilege.
Yep. The choice only works when the choices are real choices. The thing
Absolutely.
Is with choice tends to rearrange itself as a kind of hierarchy. And that means that people who don't have, as I said earlier, the agency and the financial ability to get their kids ahead are the ones that are left behind. And, you know, David's pointed out the extreme differences in the, you know, the haves and the have-nots in our system. So, you know, the Diane Ravitch, the great US education historian, says, you know, choosing a school should not be like going shopping. Parents should not have to go shopping for a school. You should just be able to rely on the fact that the school down the road will be great for your kid. And if you have other choices, then that's great. This is why it's so important that our resources to the public system are, you know, really...
Lucy's right, because it's what I call a bogus choice. If you're on $35,000, which is the minimum wage, you have no choice where to send your child. Even if you're on a median wage of $55,000, your choices are very limited. And so private schools aren't there by choice. They are, as I said before, they are select entry. They select who they want. And if you're charging $30,000 after tax, that's... you're in the top 5% earners.
So the argument of the pro-private school people, and if there is anyone here who is prepared to argue for private schools, please put up your hand, because I would love to, either as a parent or as an observer or as a taxpayer, I would really love to hear from you. Anyone here ready to take that on?
Well, is that
one lone hand I see down the back?
Look, the argument often goes.
Can I just hear from that person down the back who's in response?
Not completely pro-private school, but I'm in a position where I feel that I don't have a choice because of, by virtue where I live, mm-hmm. we don't have access to government schools. We live in South Melbourne. There is no public primary school. Our local school for primary school is a Catholic school, which is where my son is attending, and we've been assured in no uncertain terms he will not be able to get into our local government high school, which is Albert Park College, because it will be full and there will be nowhere else that is close. Okay. So
that's kind of the exception to the rule.
Yeah, but also too, I'd like to know your thoughts in relation to that, because it goes into this public versus private education.
It's a failure of the government.
I would like to support public education. I believe in public education. But, you know, in a few years' time, I feel that I will not have that choice because there's not going to be any available.
We can thank Jeff Kennett for that.
We'll come back to that South Melbourne issue in a little bit.
Just our area, though, too. Like, there's a lot of other areas.
Sure, like Docklands. Fair enough.
It's not just in that area. I have to say that in the growth corridors of Melbourne, going out to the outer east and the northeast, and... by default, the federal government has been funding fundamentalist Christian schools to set up in those growth corridors of Berwick and around that area, and have not been building public schools. Our current government has committed to building another 50 new public schools, but they won't be finished before the rail crossings are finished, I can tell you that. So by default, you're right that many people don't have a choice.
So that's a whole separate ball game about, you know, about where schools are built. But I am just keen to see if there is there no one else here who has sent their child to a private school or who went to a private school themselves.
Can I make
to argue for them?
Can I perhaps after?
Yeah, is that someone there in the front? Yes, please.
Hi, I sent my children to a private school. We'd been living overseas and they went to school in Sweden, where when there was a problem with one of them in a maths, and I went to see the teacher and the principal said, "What are you doing here?" And I said, "I've come to talk about Catherine's maths." "Well, we don't talk to the parents. It's the child," and this was at high school. We talked to them. "Oh, okay." And that was really good. They put the emphasis on the children. In coming back to Australia, and I went to a government school myself, we chose an independent school primarily because of the music and sport. We could afford to do that. Now, I've got friends who have grandchildren and their children are expecting the parents to pay for their children to go to private school. And at $30,000, I'm not in that position with grandchildren, but I'd rather put the $30,000 a year away and when they finish school, give them $200,000 to buy their first flat or something like that, because I do believe that private schools get high results, but I know many kids who left secondary school at year 10 in the western suburbs, in the southeastern suburbs, and went to private school for the last 2 years, topped the grades, and the school takes the credit for that. I don't think 2 years of schooling covers 8-10 years of government schooling. And I think it's like people now want to drive the Mercedes and the BMWs. They don't want the Fords and the Holdens. And I think it's a little bit about status.
Okay.
Madeline, I've got to, obviously my hand's been declared at the start when you said I'm on the board of MLC. And I've got to be careful here that I don't just promote MLC, because there's people here with links to all sorts of schools. But my parents scrimped and saved to send my sister and I there because they wanted the ethos of the school and they wanted music. My mother was a brilliant pianist and wanted us to go to a musical school, and it was on the railway line from Ashburton. We'd both gone to Ashburton State School and loved it. And so we went to MLC and we loved it. And what I loved about that school, I have a real anti-snobbery aspect in my life. My dad was an English migrant and his parents worked in the shipyards at Liverpool. And Dad worked in a textile factory. And I used to be proudly, and I still am, proudly sort of working class, which is a bit fake really, because I'm not really working class anymore. But what I loved about MLC and what I still love is because it's so big and because it's mid-range in its fees, I still would love them lower, but there's a lot
what
of
are
scholarships.
The fees
are around about 24, 25.
So that's mid-range?
Yes.
Yep, okay.
There might be a little bit more, but I think that's what I last saw. What I loved about that school and what I love about it still is that you have every range of socioeconomic background in the school virtually. You don't have a lot of, obviously, real battlers, but you have a lot of people of upper working class and so on. And also I love the fact that the joy we get from our AFL football team winning last year's inter-school football and the joy of the rowers and so on. And the fact that Meg Hutchins, I think, has gone to Collingwood as their first manager of their footy team. She comes from MLC, and Peter Searle, the umpire, comes from MLC. This sort of thing. We get a lot of joy out of having students that are in every walk of life.
Mm-hmm.
And the school is proudly open entry.
You'd get that in a government school, though, as well, wouldn't you?
Oh, definitely, yeah. Yes. But yeah. I'm just saying that's one reason why I love MLC for that, sure. Because it does have a bit of that earthiness. And
One of the things that we need to point out, however, is when you went, it wasn't that long ago, but when you went to MLC as a girl, as a gal, there were no public subsidies. Parents paid their full wage.
So just,
for that.
Can I just get back to this public subsidy issue? Because given that there aren't many people here keen to argue the pro-private lobby,
what a shame.
And that 34% of Australian children do go to private and Catholic schools, David, you might have more up-to-date figures than me, but I have the Productivity Commission's report on Government Services 2014, which said that while governments invest an average of around $16,000 per government school student in terms of recurrent costs, the figure for private school students was around $8,500. So the argument that is commonly made by private school fans is that they are subsidising schools where their kids don't go,
mm-hmm.
To a greater extent than, the state is subsidising them. And so, in fact, they're paying for the privilege of educating other people's children.
Yes, it's an interesting argument, isn't it? The private school lobby here in Victoria claims that between $3,000 and $5,000 per child is saved to the public by sending a child to a private school.
Yeah.
The most up-to-date figures are that the average state and federal subsidy for private schools' recurrent costs is $9,000. The $16,000 figure is correct. The major cost, recurrent cost, are salaries, teacher salaries.
Mm.
And teacher salaries, we want to employ the very best people, and we should be paying them even more than we're currently paying them. Salaries in the public school systems are often higher because they have enterprise bargaining that private schools, especially the elite schools, don't have.
Mm-hmm.
The Catholic school system has a very strong union, as does the public school system, but there is not a union that bargains in the private school system. Teachers are paid by individual contract in schools like MLC.
So are you saying that you don't buy that argument then?
Absolutely, don't buy the argument. It's like saying, hands up all of those who are here tonight who have done a long-haul overseas flight. Hand up. Keep your hand up if you've gone business class. Keep your hand up if
don't
you've
be
gone
ashamed, Eleanor.
Keep your hand up if you've gone first class. There's two. Hand up if you've never travelled overseas on long-haul flight. There's got to be one person here. Okay, well, those of us who have travelled economy, do we really want to be subsidising the people who are travelling business and first class?
I thought the first class subsidised the economy.
I don't think so.
That was always my understanding of it.
It's a good argument, yes.
Well, that's what people suggest who travel first class.
I can assure you that is definitely not me, Dave.
But of course, when you go on that long-haul flight to London or Los Angeles, you all arrive there at the same time, just with a different modicum of comfort.
And they get off
And they have much better food.
That's how pushy they
are. All right, look, I appreciate the analogy, but I think we might get it back on track. Lucy, you've been dying to talk for a while.
Yeah, I'm dying to talk about the choices that parents make, because I think this is what, when we really get to the nub of private versus public, this is what we're all wanting to talk about, is what drives the decisions that we make. And I interviewed a lot of people for my book. You know, parents decide often based on their own experience. Nostalgia is a very powerful reason for the choices people make. Mm. If you went to a private school, you think that that's a better system. Sometimes parents want to have the exact opposite experience if they had a terrible time at school. But also there's a lot of fear built into the decisions that we make. And this is where I think we've got to ask ourselves some pretty serious questions about what are we afraid of. And are our fears justified? And you've always got to ask the next question about them. I mean, are we scared of the public system? Why are we scared? Are the classes too big? Are the kids too rough? Do we really need our kids to be with people like us? And this is where I come to the you know, where the rubber hits the road for so many people and the choices they make when there is so much choice in the system, that, you know, people think, oh, I want my kids to be with people like us. And I think that's something that's really worth shaking and having a really serious look at. Why? Why do we want that? What sort of society do we want? There is no area of public policy that informs the society that we have and the society that we want than education. So I really, really would urge everyone to take a good, hard look at their ideas about the choices that they make.
So when the question was asked earlier about what would you think if we got rid of private schools completely, and you said, I think it'd be great.
Yeah.
What would you like to...
ideologically speaking.
What would you like to replace... But yet you are sending your son to a private school.
Yeah.
I'm full
of hypocrisy.
What would you like to... we all are on many levels.
Very
Don't
confusing.
Worry about it.
It's very confusing.
What would you ideally like to replace it with?
Oh, I would like to take religion out of schools altogether. Religion is for the mosques, churches and synagogues. I really believe that. I think we should have a completely public system, mm-hmm. no private schools. Mm-hmm. But it's going to take, it'd be like turning around the Titanic. They've done it. It happens elsewhere. It happened in Finland 40 years ago.
So they used to have
private schools.
Well, Finland still has private schools, but they're not government funded. If they charge fees of any kind... Mm.
There's
private schools, but they don't charge fees?
That's right.
You're not allowed to charge fees.
Right, so they're just privately operated.
So there are religious schools, there are Steiner schools that are not part of the public school system, but if they charge their parents' fees, they don't get any public support, any fees at all. I would want to propose that private schools be given some time to get their houses in order again, because it's only since the late 1960s that they started to receive any public funding at all, and that we reduce by 25% every 4 years their public subsidy, and so within a period of 10 or 12 years, they would be receiving $0. As it is today in the Catholic education system, the Catholic Church, the richest state in the world, only contributes 3% of the recurrent costs, 3% of the recurrent costs of their school system. Parents, 23%, and the rest is out of your and my pocket.
We've got 5 minutes left, so I'd like to get through a few more questions. I can't actually...
There are a couple in the back.
Yeah, okay, on the left-hand side there, please.
Oh, just a question for David Zingier. Given that the private schools, the so-called private schools, receive large amounts of government funding, and yet they don't seem to be accountable and they don't have a free access for students, they can pick and choose who they enrol, but they get, you know, obviously very, very generous public funding. What do you think of the ethics of this?
Okay, well, we'll try and keep that quite short, David, if you can, so we can get to a few more questions.
First of all, in their defence, they are accountable in as much as they have to comply to certain standards that are applied to all schools. But on the other hand, they have an exemption to employ people who are not of their faith, for example, and that's currently before our Victorian Parliament to change that law. So, you know, they take public money but are not answerable not to
as,
all the laws.
Not as accountable. Okay. Mm. Next question.
There seems to be a mantra developing regarding federal funding that putting money into the system doesn't actually increase results. You know, having proper resourcing doesn't increase people's results. I'm also interested if any on the panel have understood the OECD report that said Australia was spending more money on education but not achieving the results. Do you know whether that includes funding to both the private and the public system, or was it only analysing funding to the public system?
But was that something you looked at, Lucy?
I did look at the whole PISA system. I mean, that specific question might be one for David, but the OECD reports that come out every 3 years are kind of used as a blunt political tool to say we're not performing and look at the money we're spending, it's not working. Which is usually said by people who usually like a lot of money and they don't want to put it into education. But the specifics, David, would have been much better placed to answer that.
Sure. Look, I've read the reports over the years and I've read the most recent report and it's true but not true. The funding is global, so it's to all education, public and private. The facts are, and these are from the Productivity Commission, that over the last 5 years there's been a 14% additional increase of government funding, of federal funding to private schools, to public schools, with a commensurate 30% to independent schools, so-called independent schools, and 33% to Catholic schools. Funding increase over time. So when Simon Birmingham goes out and says we've increased funding by 23% and our results are flatlined, he's actually not telling the whole story. If the funding was targeted where it was most needed and 80% of all disadvantaged learners are in the public school system, if we were able to target additional funding and send it to where it's needed, to those lower performing schools, then we would see over time, it's not going to happen overnight, but over time, with regular inputs of additional resources, that once again Australia would be in the top three of the so-called league tables, for whatever that's worth.
Okay. Madeline, I make a quick comment?
Yeah.
I'll be quick. A lot of wonderful things are happening in public schools and in private schools in terms of teaching children how to problem solve and how to think. And I sometimes wonder if the PISA test doesn't quite give us enough credit because of rote learning compared with being able to think. And if I can just give a quick example, visiting these schools that have got a practicing principal, staying with a principal for a while, I went to Wangaratta West Primary School. I walked around the school with the principal and the intern principal. This is just a couple of years ago. And I went into a grade 5 class, so little kids, 10 years old, and they've all got their furniture into circles. They're all on these cubes, I think from the Kevin Rudd's money, and with little wheels, and they're all in groups working away. And I walked over to a group of boys and I said to them, "And what are you doing, boys?" And they said, not being surprised by a strange elderly woman coming in, they said, "We're doing persuasive writing."
Now,
grade 5, yeah. 10 years old.
Yeah.
Persuasive writing, you know, the year 12's battle with where you get a topic and you have to argue strongly for and against and come down on one side. So I try to keep a straight face and I said, "And what's the topic?" "Oh, another little boy says, "Should the federal government increase the quota of refugees?" And I said, as if I'm speaking to my year 12's, I said, "And what source materials are you using?" And another little boy says, "Oh, an article from The Age and an article from The Australian."
Yeah. Wonderful.
And I said, "And which one's the most useful?" And another little boy said, "Probably the article from The Age. But do you know it's got a lot of rhetorical questions in it?"
That's
just
wonderful.
Real learning going on, and there's me standing there flabbergasted.
And that's not caught up by the league tables necessarily, no. And particularly not by the international.
No, and this is, you know, we need more of these stories because so much about public education is in the frame of crisis.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
All the time. It's the way we talk about it. It's in crisis. Mm. It's no wonder people have this fear.
The crisis is talked up. It's a political manoeuvre to underplay the performance of public schools. Public schools are the cornerstone of a democracy, of a vibrant democracy. If we don't have a strong public education system, we can look at our democracy going downhill very quickly.
And that comes back to parent choice, you know, because of that fear and that crisis being played up, we tend to think, oh, well, will we be putting our darling children at risk if we send them to a public school? Mm. So those stories are wonderful. We need more of them.
Mm.
We need a better publicist in public schools.
I'd like to have those Year 5 sitting up here sometime. That would sound like a very good idea.
They'd be happy to come, I'm sure.
Yeah. We have run out of time, I'm afraid, and some really great questions from the audience and some great responses, of course, from the panel. So thank you very much to all of you for coming. Just a reminder, Lucy's book... Beautiful Failures is at the back for sale. If you could just join me in thanking the panel, Eleanor Brereton, David Zinger and Lucy Clark.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Wheeler Centre podcast. Don't forget to visit wheelercentre.com for the best in books, writing and ideas from Melbourne, Australia and the world.